The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 277, five books that have affected my spiritual life, with D. Freeman, Jerry Johnston, Alan Roberts, J. Frederick Voris, Jr., Allison Pingree, and Arthur Wiscombe.
Well, I guess we better start. My name is D. Freeman, and I'm kind of a permanent staff volunteer fixture at Sunstone. This is the first time I've chaired a session, and I'm really delighted because every year I go to five books. And I feel like it's a real privilege to hear some of my favorite thinkers from a variety of fields express how books affected them. As a writer myself, I have a very deep feeling about books, how they change your life. As a teacher, I'm very mystified by why people don't read and what attracts certain people to reading fiction or nonfiction and what touches people. Sometimes it's not the things that teach people that touches people, and I find that very interesting as far as looking at things philosophically, but especially in a religion. And since we have such a wonderfully stacked panel, I'm just to go right into their short biographical introductions. But I could be here all session long reading their vitas. Jerry Johnston, with the Deseret News, writes a column, Ideally Speaking, that's on the front page of the religion section, I believe. He has written several books, Dads and Other Heroes, that was published by Covenant in 1992, Spirits in the Leaves by Signature in 1995. He's also published fiction and nonfiction in a couple of dozen magazines and journals. And he is on the board of directors for the Association of Mormon Letters and on the advisory board of the Utah State University Alumni Magazine. He has been recognized in awards with a first place award in criticism, columns featured in the Associated Press, and the Utah Arts Council, Reader's Digest, and Utah Society for Professional Journalists. He will be our first speaker. Next, we will hear from Alan Roberts. He is an architect and co-editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. He graduated from BYU, and his graduate studies were done in architecture and philosophy at the University of Utah. He is the co-author of Salamander, The Story of the Mormon Forgery Murders, plus books on architecture and history, and numerous other articles on religious studies. He is on the board for MESA, a residency center for writers and artists, board member of several historical preservation societies, history and humanitarian organizations. He has won awards for architectural excellence and best article awards from the Mormon History Association.
That one.
Mottman, best article of the year award from for A Church Divided by the Society of Utah Journalism. He is the father of five wonderful children. He is also the former editor and president of the Sunstone Foundation. In the middle of the panel, we have Fred Voros, and he is the Assistant Utah Attorney General, Section Chief, in Criminal Appeals Division. He has a Bachelor's of English from BYU and a JD from BYU Law School. He's written several articles, Do You Still Believe in Magic?, Why the 60s Generation is Losing Its Faith, Freedom of Speech in the Household of Faith, What Was the Book of Mormon Buried with King Follett, and others, a few children. His children's book is The Stones of the Temple. He is married to Vicki, and they have four children. Allison Pingree, which we're happy to have here, is our second to last speaker. She is acting associate director for the Derek Bok Center of Teaching and Learning at Harvard University. She has a daughter, Emma Pingree Cannon, who's a year and a half, I think, and she's married to Mark Cannon. Her writings go on forever. I think we've all heard about her, and I really couldn't find a way to edit her accomplishments, so I'll just say that I would be very happy to hear from Allison. And our last speaker, I don't have a piece of paper for, is retired philosopher Arthur Whitcomb. He is a writer and educator in Salt Lake City. I'm particularly interested in hearing from him because I am a philosophy major at the University of Utah, and not many people are in that field because usually in theology, such as we live under in this church, at present time, there is no room for philosophy. It is a dead art. When you have such a theocracy, you have no room for philosophy. And so I will be very interested to see what five books have changed his life or influenced him. And now we will hear from the speakers in the order in which they are in the program.
Yesterday, Kurt Bench, is that on? Yeah. Yesterday, Kurt Bench called me to see which books I was going to be talking about, the five books. And it turned out that he not only didn't have any of the books, but he says if he had them, he probably couldn't sell them anyway, so it didn't matter. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my life, and then you can see how these books kind of fit in along the chronology of my life. These aren't books, I think, that would help everyone all the time, or maybe not even be of interest to any people in different stages of life. But there's an old Buddhist saying, which many of you have heard. It says, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And a lot of these books were the teachers that I needed as I was making that journey. And at these crucial moments of my life, these are books that, you know, got me back on true north, as William Stafford used to say, got the compass directed. There have been points in my life when Jonathan Livingston Seagull could have been a very important book to me, but right now I'm going to talk a little bit about my life's journey and how these books kind of served as road markers along the way. I was born and raised in Brigham City with a very devout family, a very strong father, and I spent a good share of my youth as a rebelling against that strong father. As an angry young folk singer of the 60s, you remember us all, I'm sure. And it gave me a sour taste for authority, which spun me out into the world for 20 years. And I careened around and constructed wonderful ideas for myself. But I think me and everyone else who knew me knew that my heart was really back in Brigham City and back at the heart of the Mormon religion. As I look back at it now, the analogy I sometimes use is that I'd constructed kind of an elaborate mansion of philosophy of myself, but it didn't have any warmth. There was no hearth. And I came back to Mormonism, and all I really had was an open fire, and I preferred that a lot better. But over the years, as I've studied more and gotten to know a lot more Mormon thinkers and teachers, I've been able to kind of find a way to build something that's really quite lovely out of it all. One of my favorite moments, I think, was at a B.H. Roberts conference on humor when J.D. Williams stood up and he talked about his youth when he was going to leave. And finally, he decided that any church that was big enough for Sterling McMurrin was big enough for him. And Lowell Banion served that purpose for me, as he did for hundreds of others. Today, as been said, I write for the Deseret News. I have a column in the Sunday section called Ideally Speaking, which is kind of an interfaith column. I try to focus a lot on other religions and show how people are alike. John Hughes, our new editor, a Christian Science Monitor Pulitzer Prize winner, his idea is that we're going to try to find ways that the community can come together, and we're going to try to avoid polarizing people. And I like that idea, and I've tried very hard to do that. And it's been a lot of fun. I've gotten some good response from it, and I don't know where it'll eventually lead, but that's kind of what I'm doing now. The first book I'm going to talk about real quickly is a book that got me writing the way I write. As I was making this journey back around the bend and coming back, coming to myself, as the parable of people like me goes, I set up an interview. The nice thing about being me is that if I like a book, I can call the author and talk to them and write it off as my job, you know. And Harold Kushner was coming to town to talk to the synagogue. Kushner once wrote a little book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People, which was a blockbuster bestseller. And his next book was called Who Needs God? And it's a book with, you'll notice it doesn't have a question mark after it. It's because the book is basically a list of people who need God. And for Kushner, that's just about everybody. And what Kushner did is when I sat down with him and interviewed him, he made me realize what kind of writer I was. I've always been a writer. And as many of you probably know, you start out trying different things and different audiences and wearing different hats and different styles. You know, I was the lofty poet for a while, and then I was the hard-boiled fiction writer. And finally I realized that I was what the academics sometimes call a popularizer. And there's usually kind of a sneer on their face when they say that. And it's someone who is who writes just at about an eighth grade level of vocabulary, but with ideas that go a little deeper than that. And you write for a popular audience, and you don't apologize for that. And Kushner talked to me about that for a long time, and his book is like that. And it made me finally take a little pride in the kind of things that I was doing. His book, I think, is wonderfully put together. It's got a lot of the old-fashioned storytelling techniques. It's a book about the Psalms, and he talks about the Psalms, and then he'll bounce off of the Psalms into personal experiences and things like that. But it's set up so that there's a lot of foreshadowing and flashbacks, conflicts, things that you'd find in a good Mickey Spillane thriller. And I was just very impressed with his ability to express in the vernacular some very difficult ideas. And after I met him, I knew that that's what I wanted to be, was a Harold Kushner kind of writer. So Who Needs God was very influential to me, getting me going in my career at the Deseret News Now. The second book I didn't see coming. It kind of blindsided me while I was out in the hinterlands, being a prodigal of sorts. I'd gotten really ill and had a bad case of the blues, and I was just very despondent. And I grabbed a book, and many of you, I'm sure, have read and heard of it, Thomas Merton's The Seven-Story Mountain. Now, Thomas Merton was raised in France in a strong Catholic upbringing. He was an American. He had a first-rate education. He came back to America, became a bohemian in Greenwich Village, began doing wild and crazy things there, paintings and poetry. And he was touched by a little book that was called Diary of a Country Priest. That's another book that isn't on my list, but I would recommend. And it slowly spun him back towards God and eventually into a monastery in Gethsemane, Kentucky, where he became a Cistercian, or as we call them here in Utah, a Trappist. And he became one of the great modern thinkers of Catholicism and all Christianity. And this is his life story, The Seven-Story Mountain. It tells about his life. And the thing that affected me about this book, it was I started to read it, and I couldn't stop reading it. It was one of these things that I guess I had been so malnourished that I just started to just down it and just chew on it almost. The image that comes to mind now is back when my grandfather, a dairy farmer, would milk the cows. He would put a pie plate down, and then at the end of milking the cows, he'd splash milk into that pie plate, and the cats would come out and just lap at it. It's about 1,000 miles an hour. Maybe some of you have seen that. That's how I felt about this book. I was just devouring it. And that led me to see that I hadn't taken very good care of myself. I'd letting myself go, I guess is what we'd say. And I was finally getting some nourishment and getting some strength. And Thomas Merton's book is the one that started to give me a little bit of the, not only the resolve, but the nutrients I needed to get me back going right. Book number three. I chose this book because there are so many wonderful moments in it, and I've used this book so much when I've written and talked. It's A.N. Wilson's biography of C.S. Lewis. Now, I don't know how many of you have read this. Wilson is a wonderful writer, and Lewis is a wonderful subject. And there's a scene in the middle of the book. It's Lewis's conversion. And it happens when he's walking, I think, in Cambridge with J.R.R. Tolkien. And Lewis, of course, who was the consummate intellectual, is going on and on about how you can't base a religion on the on the sufferings of a tortured individual like Jesus, and Lewis is railing, fighting, you know, kicking against the pricks, I guess is the biblical term. And after he was all done, Tolkien, of course, who wrote the Hobbit and everything else, looked at Lewis and says, Jack, he said, failure to believe is just a failure of imagination. And that quote stuck with me for a long time. And after this, Lewis, of course, converted a cross and became a Christian. It outraged his friends at Cambridge. One of them said that Lewis's conversion to theology was a terrible loss for British literature and really not much of a gain for theology. That was his opinion. But Lewis makes a few quotes there, and about in the middle he says, enough had been thought, it was time to do something. And that was kind of how I've come to feel, too. It was time to do something. Book number four. I think it said, people say Augustine, but I guess others say Augustine, but it's St. Augustine's Confessions. And this is a little bit of a loftier book. And I think the thing that impressed me about this was the constancy of belief. That when you read his confessions, the scripture's right. God is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Augustine talks about God just the way Gordon Hinckley and other people today talk about God. And his impressions and his feelings are not that much different. And I think reading what he had to say, and of course, you know, Augustine was a bit of a prodigal himself. He was a rounder and a philosopher. He's the one whose famous quote was, God give me chastity, but not quite yet. And another one of his quotes was, God, as my offering to you, I give you my words and my language, but first give to me what I got to give to you. And he was a marvelous writer, and I think all of us have favorite Catholic saints, even though if we're not Catholics, we have our favorites, and he's probably mine. His mother was Santa Monica, or St. Monique, I guess, and she's a saint today because she prayed Augustine back into the church. And he came back and became the Bishop of Ypres and wrote his Confessions in the City of God and everything like that. The edition I read is the modern translation where the Confessions is basically a 300-page prayer. And it was earlier versions, it was written with thee, thou, and thine, and all that. And it gets very tedious at times. The modern versions have gone back to the more familiar you, which I think makes it more readable. But it's a wonderful book, just full of thousands and thousands of wonderful thoughts. And the final book is by the man that McMurrin called the Mormon saint, Lowell Banion. I'd heard about Lowell Banion my whole life. Emma Lou Thayne had talked about him. Eugene England talked about him. Marion D. Hanks had talked about him. I'd never met him, and he was getting very old, so I called him up, and I says, I'd like to meet you. For no purpose at all except just to meet you. And of course, it's Lowell Banion. He said, come on by. And I went by, and I picked up this little book, The Things That Matter Most. And a lot of you all know about this one. It was based on a speech that he gave that I think it was in Boston originally that just set people on their heels about how generous and warm and open it is. And Lowell Banion showed me that you can be a Mormon and not give up a lot of credibility in other areas. I remember the thing when we were having our discussion, it unnerved me a little because he was listening so hard, and I didn't want him to listen that hard. I wanted him to kind of stop listening. But he was very focused on me and everything I was saying, and I know he was picking up things about me, probably knew my whole history by the time I got out of there. But at one point I said, and I'm not going to mention his name, but there was a general authority, I guess, that he had done some real grappling with. And I said, I understand that he's forbidden you from ever writing, or they've forbidden you from ever writing for the church magazines or any of the publications, that you can't even publish with official church publications anymore. I says, how can you belong to a church where these people do that to you? And he just very calmly said, well, it isn't their church. And that was a statement that just really stayed with me. And it goes back to my youth, my father, the authority problems. It wasn't my father's church. It wasn't anyone's church. It was God's church. And because of Lowell Banion, I'm kind of rowing the boat closer and closer to the other shore, and I'm looking forward to see of all the things that lie ahead. Thank you very much.
Kurt Bench called me too, and none of my books are on his list either. I guess it doesn't necessarily take religious books to influence your religious thinking. As far as my favorite saint, I think it must be Saint Jude, the saint of lost causes. being really organizationally challenged, I've elected to write my comments so as not to trip over my thoughts with my words. I thought the assignment was to speak about one book which has most influenced our religious life. But as a dedicated pluralist with eclectic interests and tastes, I usually resist answering questions about my favorite color, music, movie, or book. So consistent to form, there has not been a single book or piece of writing, but many which have influenced my religious life and shaped my spiritual development. The important discovery for me in pondering this topic has been the realization that I have been as much or more influenced by writing as by any other source, including discussions with others and the direct personal experiences of the rest of my life. Thus, I find that I have many of the characteristics of the Mormon rationalist described in the paper presented earlier today by Robert Anderson. It has been by design and with serious intent that I have sought to learn the truth about the relationship between myself and God through seeking out knowledge and insight from the literature of the church and the world. The books that had the greatest impact on my youth and young adulthood, during which my religious life was formed, were the New Testament and the Book of Mormon. I had read them both three times before I turned 19 and left home to serve a mission. By this time, I had also read Jesus the Christ, A Marvelous Work and a Wonder, and the Articles of Faith, and had attended 4 years of LDS seminary at 6:15 every morning. I was an avid reader then, and also had devoured all I could find by William Faulkner and Thomas Wolfe, who, with the help of thoughtful English teachers and movies like Dr. Zhivago, helped me get early glimpses of the complexities of life and what I thought of as the outside world. I grew up in two states in the mission field and was one of only a few Mormons in one high school and the only one in the second. So I found a way then to be insulated and far more influenced by my small island of Mormonism than by the greater outside culture. Though I was educated mostly in the 1960s, I did not become an intellectual product of the 60s until the early 1980s. I guess I'm a living anachronism. As I entered and served my mission, I was as believing and devout in my practice of religion as a young Mormon man could be. While I was surprised to learn that I had won the Milwaukee Stakes Melchizedek Priesthood Contest on gospel knowledge, I was the only one not surprised a few months later when I entered the mission field already having memorized the 91 pages of missionary discussions. So, do you get the idea, this insufferable young Mormon Orthodox believer? The zeal I gained in large measure because of the impact of the scriptures on my belief system. They were the center of my life. My ideological foundation came from the New Testament as I learned of the life of Jesus and came to love both his teachings and works. But the emotional power that fueled my religious drive was the Book of Mormon. I still remember reading it for the third time just before heading off for my mission. I would read passages, then close my eyes and imagine the scenes in my mind. I could visualize everything clearly, and the events seemed to me to be as real as anything in my actual life. In my naive way of knowing, I knew or completely believed the book to be true in the sense that it was an ancient book, that the events therein had actually happened, and that the precepts taught were correct and from God. This power of conviction remained with me for many years. During my university years, I was not so much influenced by what I read in my classes as by what I chose to read for my own edification. As a counterbalance to all the academic reading, I began to read historical fiction. An important book proved to be The Source by James Michener, although its impact on me would be delayed for several years. The source tells the long story of a group of Israeli and Arab archaeologists excavating a tell, or a dig, of ancient civilization in the Holy Land. The story of each group of people occupying the place is told starting with the first inhabitants and moving chronologically to the present. The ironic twist is that the people being discovered are the direct ancestors of those doing the investigation. More important to me, however, was the subplot, which dealt with the development of the idea of God. As the precursors of the Hebrews emerged as a distinct group, they were pantheists who saw higher powers in elements of the natural environment around them. As their society became more complex, it began to create and worship gods of their neighboring peoples. In time, they became monotheistic and sought their one god in the mountains. As they became less nomadic, they built permanent cities and in them constructed elaborate temples along with literature, laws, and liturgy. These occurred as a natural byproduct of their intermixing with other cultures while trying to preserve their own identity. Their wisdom literature, now revered as scripture, and their later books of commentary also developed naturally as increasingly sophisticated questions about God and life were answered by increasingly complex stories, requirements, and religious structures. As the story revealed, the people's systems of government, economy, education, and social culture developed in progressively complex stages in the same way as did their religion. As I later found the same patterns in other societies, it began to occur to me that it is most likely that man has created gods in his own image for his own purposes rather than the other way around. By the time I later read A History of God and The Power of Myth and similar works, my opinions on the subject of God had already been formed. For those who still wonder, researching the Mark Hoffman story for the book Salamander had no significant impact on my religious views, but rather confirmed what I already believed. After completing my university education and getting married, I went through a period of reading the biographies of people I admired, among them Tom Dooley, Albert Schweitzer, Mohandas Gandhi, Sir Thomas More, and Charles Darwin. The most influential biography was the one of Darwin. After reading it, I also read his 1859 Origin of the Species, and about the same time, for balance, I suppose, Joseph Fielding Smith's unconvincing opus, Man, His Origin and Destiny. Darwin was raised in a religious home and was devoutly religious himself. He was preparing for a life in the ministry when he secured a position as naturalist on the Beagle and took the exploratory trip during which he made discoveries which changed him indelibly and changed the world. On one small, remote island, he found 14 varieties of a small finch that had all evolved from a common ancestor. Some had large beaks and ate nuts from inland trees, while others had small beaks and lived only along the ocean shore. Each variety had changed sizes, colors, and other characteristics to adapt to and survive in the differing environments of the island. From these modest observations, Darwin began to develop his theories of evolution and natural selection. At first, Darwin struggled to harmonize his naturalistic findings and their implications with his religious beliefs, but eventually the natural evidence and theoretical truths derived therefrom overpowered his earlier convictions. From the time of his first writings, Darwin's findings and conclusions were heavily condemned by both religionists and other scientists. While he was reluctant to publicly draw the conclusions regarding the origin of man that others were so quick to draw, he nevertheless spent the remaining several decades of his life explaining and defending his scientific truths against an onslaught of attackers. He did live long enough, however, to see his work obtain widespread acceptance around the world. As interested as I was in Darwin's findings and writings, I was equally interested in how gracefully he dealt with the faith versus knowledge dilemma and how dignified he was throughout all his trials. Beginning in the mid-1970s, I began what has become a 22-year period of involvement in independent Mormon periodical and book writing, editing, and publishing with Sunstone, Signature Books, the Journal of Mormon History, and Dialogue. During these years, I did considerable research and writing of my own, and have read thousands of book and manuscripts written by probably hundreds of others. Like the books I've already mentioned, these have had a large cumulative impact on my thinking. I've also been affected by the many manuscripts and presentations encountered while serving on the board of the Humanities Council. Since I read to be influenced, I try to keep an open mind about what I read, although every new idea or piece of information is always evaluated in relation to what I already believe I know. The overall impact of all that I've read, added to my own life's experience, has been a series of religious moves from conservative to liberal, dogmatic to non-creedal, somewhat exclusive and intolerant to more inclusive and tolerant, judgmental to, well, still judgmental, except that now I'm really right, or at least I think I am. I have moved from being a literalist to a relativist, from a theist to a deist, to one who now wonders if our concept of God is really at all consistent with the nature of this world God is said to have created and managed. I have gone from being a believer to a rationalist, although one who still believes in many things, but in different things than I believed in when I was younger. I have migrated in position from a religionist to a humanist who believes that humans, however flawed and limited by the absence of supernatural assistance, are responsible for and capable of elevating the human condition by creating better art, literature, government, and social systems. Lately, I've become more interested in better understanding the world than trying to change it or to prove anything to it. This new pacifism will be, I suspect, temporary, part of a transitional period of rethinking old assumptions, reestablishing directions, and planning my future course. The benefit of this rest period has come from my brief acquaintance with a little Eastern literature, although I admit to being bothered somewhat by the idea of a passive, laissez-faire approach to life. I tend to read several books at the same time, working through each of them slowly according to my current interest. I have read and reread the book called The 100, a book containing 100 chapters, each one on the most influential people in the world's history, presented in order, starting with the most important person. What I find interesting is the rationale for ranking people's importance based on a criteria that measures influence. I read this book because it puts in perspective my own interest in living a life of influence for the good of the world. Most recently, I have become intrigued again, as I was in high school and college, with the history of the Roman Empire and later Italy. I don't have an explanation for this. It's just the way it is. I am also slowly working my way through Soloway's opus, Born to Rebel, a book 26 years in the writing. Over 100 historians studied the lives of more than 6,500 important persons in history. The book concludes that birth order, together with the success of parent-child relationships, is the surest predictor of any individual's nature. I have found this book quite insightful in understanding my own history of spiritual meanderings. Firstborn children tend to accept existing systems of authority, especially as related to their parents, and are more resistant to new ideas. Children born later, however, are typically more creative and more receptive to new ideas, including radical countercultural thought. The exception is when firstborns have major conflicts with a parent, in which instance they take on later-born characteristics, sometimes to an extreme. I find myself within this exception. Initially, my religious, political, and general worldview beliefs mirrored those of my parents with whom I had an early positive relationship. As I matured, however, I came into serious conflict with my father. Subconsciously and only understood recently, I became like a later-born, questioning and eventually replacing my early beliefs with new ones which differed from those of my parents. And so, as so many others have experienced, this shift has caused much difficulty and heartache. Still, I think myself, if not happier, still better for having a sense that my present spirituality is more grounded in reality than fantasy. I hope to continue the search for myself, the real world, and the elusive, unseen, and unknown powers beyond, in part through the reading out of the best books, as Mormons are wont to do.
This is a great assignment to have. I love making lists of favorite things. I started this with a few assumptions. One is that the scriptures wouldn't be on my list because that was just too easy and not informative enough to you, I guess. Also, I didn't try to pick the five books that most influenced my life because that would have resulted in a brain cramp. I couldn't have issued five, I guess. I also figured I had about 15 minutes, five books, about 3 minutes a book. That's not very long to talk about each one. I thought I'd let the books do the talking rather than myself, primarily. Also, I'd like to start with an apology. I'd like to apologize to the books that didn't get chosen, but might have. And so in the spirit of doing work for the dead, I guess, this is the list. Bartlett's Familiar Quotations, Brideshead Revisited, Collected Poems of Gerard Manley Hopkins, The Hiding Place, LDS Hymnals, John Doyle Lee, Lighten Up, The Speeches and Writings of Abraham Lincoln, A Man for All Seasons, A Mormon Hierarchy Series by Quinn, The Mormon Mountain Meadows Massacre, Peter Pan, The Sacred and the Profane, St. Jones, Strangers in Paradox, Sanctity of Dissent, The Subtle Power of Spiritual Abuse, Virtually Normal, Waiting for God, Walled in the Wind and the Willows, Scott Peck's works, and all the works of C.S. Lewis, except the one I picked. So, that's over with. I was pretty confident that no one else on the panel would pick my first book. This is a book from my childhood, and it's called Mr. Dog. And we're not over yet, but I think I'm probably pretty safe in that. I picked a book from my childhood, one from my adolescence, one from my 20s, one from my 30s, and one from my 40s. So this is a book from my childhood. It's by Margaret Wise Brown, one of my heroes. Once upon a time, there was a funny dog named Crispin's Crispian. He was named Crispin's Crispian because he belonged to himself. In the mornings, he woke himself up, and he went to the icebox, and he gave himself some bread and milk. He was a funny old dog. He liked strawberries. Then he took himself for a walk, and he went wherever he wanted to go. So he goes about his adventures. He chases cats and other dogs. But he didn't catch them because he ran bang into a little boy. "Who are you? And who do you belong to?" asked the little boy. "I am Crispin's Crispian, and I belong to myself," said Crispian. "Who and what are you?" "I am a boy," said the boy, "and I belong to myself." "I am so glad," said Crispin's Crispian. "Come and live with me." So they go to the butcher to get his poor dog a bone, as Crispian said. They have a little dinner in his house. You probably can't see these pictures at all, but it's part of the drill, I guess. They have their dinner, and then they clean up. Crispin's Crispian was a conservative. He liked everything at the right time. Dinner at dinner time, lunch at lunchtime, and sunrise at sunrise, and sunset at sunset. And at bedtime, he liked everything in its own place. The cup in the saucer, the chair under the table, the stars in the heavens, the moon in the sky, and himself in his own little bed. You can see the kind of biblical influence on her writing. And then what did he do? He curled in a warm little heap and went to sleep, and he dreamed his own dreams, and that was what the dog who belonged to himself did. And what did the boy who belonged to himself do? The boy who belonged to himself curled in a warm little heap and went to sleep, and he dreamed his own dreams, and that was what the boy who belonged to himself did. Well, I think from this book I got the idea that I was in charge of my own life, that I was a boy who belonged to himself. An important idea if you're going to survive in the church, I think, which, by the way, I chose later in life. I wasn't born into it. Also, I think this book fixed in my mind the notion of equality. You could be a dog or you could be a boy, and everybody went to bed the same way, and everybody had the same kind of dinner. And, of course, usually the dog follows the boy home. In this case, the boy followed the dog home. So those were important ideas for a preschooler. The book From my youth is one I picked up off the shelf. It was my mother's book, a book by C.S. Lewis, The Screwtape Letters. Oh, I forgot to ask. How many of you are familiar with Mr. Dog? Anyone?
Is it in print? Is it in print?
No. 1952.
Copyright 52, but it's been reprinted. That's not my original book. It was destroyed by me in the process. How many familiar with The Screwtape Letters? Okay, probably 3/4 of you. Well, you know what it's about. They're letters from a senior devil to a junior devil, advising him on tempting his client, I think is the word he uses, who is a new Christian. Rather than read from a letter, I'm going to read from the introduction to the book. He explains that I live in a managerial age, in a world of admin. The greatest evil is not now done in the sordid dens of crime that Dickens loved to paint. It is not done even in concentration camps and labor camps. In those we see its final result. But it is conceived and ordered, moved, seconded, carried, and minuted in clean, carpeted, warmed, and well-lighted offices by quiet men with white collars and cut fingernails and smooth-shaven cheeks who do not need to raise their voice. Hence, naturally enough, my symbol for hell is something like the bureaucracy of a police state or the offices of a thoroughly nasty business concern. Milton has told us that devil with devil damned firm concord holds. But how? Certainly not by friendship. A being which can still love is not yet a devil. Here again, my symbol seemed to me useful. It enabled me, by earthly parallels, to picture an official society held together entirely by fear and greed. On the surface, manners are normally suave. Rudeness to one's superiors would obviously be suicidal. Rudeness to one's equals might put them on their guard before you were ready to spring your mine. For, of course, dog eat dog is the principle of the whole organization. Everyone wishes everyone else's discrediting, demotion, and ruin. Everyone is an expert in the confidential report, the pretended alliance, the stab in the back. Over all this, their good manners, their expressions of grave respect, their tributes to one another's invaluable services form a thin crust. Every now and then it gets punctured, and the scalding lava of their hatred spurts out. The book of my 20s, G.K. Chesterton's Orthodoxy. How many of you are familiar with this book? Smattering. English writer, a journalist, like Lewis, wrote a lot of popular Christian apologetics. He wrote a book called Heretics, in which he attacked a lot of the leading thinkers of his day and was challenged after that. Okay, if you're so good at seeing everyone else's faults, the faults in their worldview, give us yours. And this is the book he produced. He was, I think, around 30 when he wrote this book. I think it was 1904. He was 30 years old. Christianity alone has felt that God, to be holy God, must have been a rebel as well as a king. Alone of all the creeds, Christianity has added courage to the virtues of the Creator. For the only courage worth calling courage must necessarily mean that the soul passes a breaking point and does not break. Indeed, I approach a matter more dark and awful than it is easy to discuss. And I apologize in advance if any of my phrases fall wrong or seem irreverent, touching a matter which the greatest saints and thinkers have justly feared to approach. But in that terrific tale of the Passion, there is a distinct emotional suggestion that the author of all things, in some unthinkable way, went not only through agony, but through doubt. It is written, "Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God." No, but the Lord thy God may tempt himself. And it seems as if this was what happened in Gethsemane. In a garden, Satan tempted man, and in a garden, God tempted God. He passed in some superhuman manner through our human horror of pessimism. When the world shook and the sun was wiped out of heaven, it was not at the crucifixion, but at the cry from the cross, the cry which confessed that God was forsaken of God. And now let the revolutionists choose a creed from all the creeds and a god from all the gods of the world, carefully weighing all the gods of inevitable recurrence and of unalterable power. They will not find another god who has himself been in revolt. Nay, the matter grows too difficult for human speech. But let the atheists themselves choose a god. They will find only one divinity who ever uttered their isolation, only one religion in which God seemed for an instant to be an atheist. Pascal's Pensée. How many of you are familiar with this one? Smattering. Pensée, P-E-N-S-E-E-S. Thoughts. 17th, I believe, century. Is it difficult to hear? Sorry. Century scientist, actually, but also an avid religious writer. And this is not a book as such, but a collection of his thoughts, as the title implies. Let me give you a smattering of them. Not really at random. I've chosen them for a purpose, but from various parts of the book. There is nothing so consistent with reason as this denial of reason. Faith certainly tells us what the senses do not, but not the contrary of what they see. It is above, not against them. You abuse the trust people have in the church and make them believe anything. Jesus came to blind those who have clear sight and to give sight to the blind, to heal the sick and let the healthy die, to call sinners to repentance and justify them, and to leave the righteous to their sins, to fill the hungry with good things, and to send the rich empty away. Almost like a variation on the Magnificat. The heart has its reasons of which reason knows nothing. Nothing is too absurd for some philosopher to have said it. It's actually a quote from Cicero, but it's in his notes. My favorite, there are only two kinds of people, the righteous who think they are sinners and the sinners who think they are righteous. The world must be really blind if it believes you. And there's a useful one, future reference. The Pope hates and fears scholars who are not vowed to his obedience. Man is neither angel nor beast, and it is unfortunately the case that anyone trying to act the angel will act the beast. These are statements written in the form of statements to him from the Lord. The last two. I thought of you in my agony. I shed these drops of blood for you. And take comfort, you would not seek me if you had not already found me. Finally, the book of my 40s, early 40s. Levi Peterson's The Backslider. How many of you are familiar with this? Only one book in my life has ever made me laugh out loud and cry in public, and this is the book. I finished it sitting in a cafe at Waterton Park, Canada, and sat there with tears streaming down my face. Most of you know the story. Frank has an overactive libido. He's gotten his boss's daughter pregnant. She's a Lutheran. They've gotten married. She's now getting baptized into the Mormon church. Her family's having a hard time with it. Frank a little bit is too. He changes out of his baptismal clothes. He's there in the men's room. He flushes the urinal, and as he does, a vision appears. This doesn't normally happen in men's rooms, by the way, ladies. Prickly pear and bunch grass grew in the sandy soil. Blue-green junipers crowded close. He heard the soft plod of a horse's feet. Beneath the juniper boughs, he saw a horse's legs. The animal emerged, a shiny roan mounted by a rider. The cowboy had a beard and wore boots, ancient chaps, a denim shirt, a creased, sweat-stained Stetson. Touching spurs lightly to his mount, he reined toward Frank. I think it's so ironic that this, in my experience, ultimate expression of grace should come from a Mormon rider. Coming close, he halted and lifted a hand. It was Jesus, his face as kind as an August dawn. "You're lost," he said. Ashamed, Frank cast his eyes downward. "I expect I am." "You are feeling awfully bad." "It's not much of anything." "It isn't any bother. Hearing your griefs is my business. Go ahead, tell me." The rider pushed back his Stetson and cocked a leg over the saddle horn. The roan blinked sleepy eyes and swished his tail. "My grandmother lost four babies and went crazy in the sandhills," Frank said. "I'm sorry about that." "My little sister Elizabeth died and my mother can't get over it." "I know," Jesus said. "Your family is a sad one." "My dad died when I was 10. "That's tough," Jesus agreed. "Also, my brother cut himself off. He took the hunting knife and laid waste to his privates. Now he thinks he's a little girl named Alice. This afternoon he dug himself a pit and sat in it. He said he was waiting for the ladder of Lazarus. He's pure as an angel. He can't sin, no matter what." "The poor crazy devil." "The thing I feel worst about is I can't live righteously," Frank said. "I've got a wife I can't leave alone. I make love to her all the time. I'm cunning and devilish about thinking up new ways to do it, too. I hate healthy, decent food. I love ham and broiled steaks and pie and ice cream. I wish I had my shiny blue pickup back, my gelding booger and my boots and jeans and pearl button shirts. I wish I had my deer rifle back so I could go deer hunting. Wish I could take my wife trout fishing." Jesus had pulled a sack of Bull Durham from his shirt pocket and was rolling a cigarette. "I thought smoking was against the word of wisdom," Frank said. "It is." "How come you're smoking?" "I suppose it's a little habit I've got into." "I hope you won't take it up." "No, sir, that's not one of my inclinations." "Good. Now go on with your story." "I hate to say this. The worst thing is, I hate God." The writer raised his eyebrows, but he didn't speak. "I love the world," Frank said. "I love my wife and my little kid that hasn't been born yet. And I love a big truck under me, and I love sunrise out over the Escalante breaks, and I love the sound of the diesels running the pumps in the middle of the night. That's what I love. I hate God." "Well, I'm sorry to hear that. Myself, I love God." "I know you do. Go on." "Well, there isn't much more to say except I scraped all the skin off the back of my hand. It's in my mind to do the same as Jeremy did, except when I cut myself off, there won't be anybody around to stop the bleeding." "Why can't you believe my blood was enough?" Jesus said. "Why do you have to shed yours too?" "I don't know. There's a lot of crazy in your family." "Yes, sir, I know it. Furthermore, that Marianne is one hell of a good woman. Why don't you just settle down and enjoy her like a husband who has some good sense?" "Do you think I ought to?" "Yeah, you ought to." Jesus crushed his cigarette on the sole of his boot. He pulled his leg off the saddle horn and said, "I've got to ride. It was good to chat with you." "Yes, sir. Thank you, sir." Jesus pulled on buckskin gloves and took up the reins. "If you want to eat that damned vegetable diet of your mother's all your life, don't blame me for it. Myself, I go for food that tastes good." "Yes, sir. I'll remember that." "Do something to make your poor mother-in-law feel better. Your wife getting baptized a Mormon has been tough on her." "Yes, sir, I will, sir." "You go see a doctor with that hand. You bet." Jesus pulled his horse around and struck him lightly on the ribs with his spurs. Looking back, he said, "And work on that crap about hating God. See if you can get over it." "Yes, sir, I sure will." Pushing the urinal lever, Frank watched as water again streamed over the gleaming porcelain. Above its sound rose another sound, soft and distant, yet distinct and unmistakable, like the soughing of the wind on a far away forest. He retched, turned to the toilet, and vomited. He wiped spatters from the toilet rim. He began to cry and couldn't stop. He blew his nose 4 or 5 times, went to the basin and splashed cold water into his eyes, tried to think decisive thoughts. Still, his tears flowed fast. I'm sorry I've taken too much time. I apologize to you and you. Thank you very much.
I want to first of all start with a disclaimer. I understood the assignment to be that each of us would talk about one book, and hence there would be 5 total. So I'm speaking about only one book. The other thing I want to assure you of is that despite what it says in the printed program, I will not be singing a hymn today. It has. I did consider setting my paper to the music of a hymn, but I thought that Paul Toscano did a better job with altering the words to him, so I'll stick with the more conventional format. I want to raise 2 questions that have guided my thoughts on how the book that I've chosen for today has affected my spiritual life, and I'm defining spiritual quite broadly. And then I'd like to talk about how I think the book grapples with and illuminates those questions. So, questions. How does the past, particularly in the form of kinship bonds, a family history, family genes, a family home, shape who I am today? How much choice do I have in how that past shapes who I am? And how might those choices involve both betrayal and devotion? The second question is, what forms of loss do or might I experience in my relationships with those that I love? And what is my response to that loss? Does or can my fear of loss in those relationships become more debilitating, more limiting than the loss itself? The book that I've chosen is a novel called The Optimist's Daughter by Eudora Welty. Who here is familiar with this book? I'm curious. Okay. For those of you that aren't familiar with Welty, she's a Southern author who grew up and has lived for most of her life up till this day in Jackson, Mississippi. Welty originally published the piece in The New Yorker in 1969 and then expanded it into a novel that came out in 1972. The book received the Pulitzer Prize, and many readers, including her fellow Southerner Reynolds Price, believe that it is Welty's strongest and richest work. I first read The Optimist's Daughter as a sophomore in college in a colloquium on the family at BYU, team taught by May Blanche from the English department, Marion Bentley from the theater department, and Robert Benyon from psychology. The novel moved me deeply then, and its value to me has only increased as I've grown older, as I've gotten married, as I've given birth, as I've watched a few close friends die, and now as I've taught the course, the book in courses of my own. The novel depicts the physical and psychological journey that Laurel Hand, who is the novel's center of consciousness, makes as she travels from Chicago, where she lives and works as a fabric designer, to her childhood home in Mount Salis, Mississippi, after her father's death. Laurel's mother and husband have died long before the book begins. Laurel's mother after a long and painful illness, and Laurel's husband just 6 months after her marriage to him. So long ago. Laurel is middle-aged by the time the book begins. Laurel's father dies after the first few chapters. A large part of Laurel's return to the past is also to her father's very recent past in the form of his second wife, Faye Chisholm, a self-absorbed, opportunistic, brash woman who is younger than Laurel and who sees Laurel's father, including his final illness and death, only in terms of how she is affected, in terms of her own gains or losses. As Laurel returns to the concrete space of her past and to the friends that she grew up with, whom she still affectionately thinks of as her bridesmaids, she is forced to experience and acknowledge a flood of feelings and awareness that she has worked carefully to keep at a distance. In particular, she realizes similarities between herself, her mother, and her grandmother that she has been working hard to avoid seeing. She also realizes how betrayed her mother felt as she died. She realizes, in spite of herself, how much grief over the loss of her husband, Phil, and of her life with him that she has been containing within herself. This last realization comes as Laurel sifts through her mother's letters and papers, and it acts as a turning point that builds towards Laurel's final epiphany at the end of the novel. Here, after having closed her heart for many years in the wake of her loss, she has finally opened up to a fuller grief, and as a result, to the possibility of healing. And let me read this. This will set up the longer quote that you have in front of you that I'll read in a moment. So this is as Laurel is looking through her mother's papers. A flood of feeling descended on Laurel. She let the papers slide from her hand and the books from her knees and put her head down on the open lid of the desk and wept in grief for love and for the dead. She lay there with all that was adamant in her yielding to this night, yielding at last. Now all she had found her. The deepest spring in her heart had uncovered itself, and it began to flow again. If Phil could have lived, but Phil was lost. Nothing of their life together remained except in her own memory. Love was sealed away into its perfection and had remained there. If Phil had lived, she had gone on living with the old perfection undisturbed and undisturbing. Now, by her own hands, the past had been raised up, and he looked at her, Phil himself, here, waiting all the time, Lazarus. He looked at her out of eyes wild with the craving for his unlived life, his mouth open like a funnel's. Here, Laurel is forced to disturb the perfected, safe, and lifeless image of Phil in her mind and heart. Only then, as she begins to distinguish the static past from something much more malleable that lives on within her, can she be open to new experiences of love. She soon realizes that although, quote, left bodiless and graveless of a death made of water and fire in a year long gone, Phil in World War II, Phil could still tell her of her life. For her life, any life, she had to believe, was nothing but the continuity of its love. In the final scene of the book, which you have in front of you, Laurel and Faye confront each other. On the surface, the dispute is over a breadboard, a gift that Phil had made by hand many years ago for Laurel's mother, and which Faye now claims as her own. The board has been scarred by Faye with cigarette burns and hammer gouges. She's used it to crack walnuts. Faye basically derides the board and any meaning that it has while still fighting to keep it. This fight over the object, which embodies so very much of the past for Laurel, leads her to her final epiphanies, and these are epiphanies that have touched and taught me a great deal. So what I'd like to do at this point is to read the scene and have you follow along and then draw a few connections to my own experience. Let me just explain a few of the names. They circulate, they're blue. I don't know if I made enough. Perhaps you can share with each other. I made about 40, and we may have probably have a few more than 40 people here. Thanks for asking. The Wendell, who is referred to in the fourth paragraph, is a child who is a cousin of Faye's. Faye's family troops in for the funeral. And Wendell, Laurel sees in Wendell a younger version. Laurel sees in Wendell a younger version of Faye, a less tainted and less objectionable version of Faye. And Missouri, at the end, is one of the family's hired help. Okay. From the parlor came a soft whir, and noon struck. Oh, I have to say one more thing. Sorry. Laurel, right before this moment, Laurel has, as they've been fighting over the breadboard, Laurel has picked it up and held it over her head, as if to hit Faye. Laurel slowly lowered the board and held it out level between the two of them. "I'll tell you what, you just about made a fool of yourself," said Faye. "You were just before trying to hit me with that plank. But you couldn't have done it. You don't know the way to fight." She squinted up one eye. "I had a whole family to teach me." But of course, Laurel saw, it was Faye who did not know how to fight. For Faye was without any powers of passion or imagination in herself and had no way to see it or reach it in the other person. Other people inside their lives might as well be invisible to her. To find them, she could only strike out those little fists at random or spit from her little mouth. She could no more fight a feeling person than she could love him. "I believe you underestimate everybody on earth," Laurel said. She had been ready to hurt Faye. She had wanted to hurt her and had known herself capable of doing it. But such is the strangeness of the mind, it had been the memory of the child Wendell that had prevented her. "I don't know what you're making such a big fuss over. What do you see in that thing?" asked Faye. "The whole story, Faye. The whole solid past," said Laurel. "Whose story? Whose past?" "Not mine," said Faye. The past isn't a thing to me. I belong to the future. Didn't you know that?" And it occurred to Laurel that Faye might already have been faithless to her father's memory. "I know you aren't anything to the past," she said. "You can't do anything to it now." "And neither am I, and neither can I," she thought. "Although it has been everything and done everything to me, everything for me, the past is no more open to help or hurt than was father in his coffin. The past is like him, impervious, and can never be awakened. It is memory that is the somnambulist. It will come back in its wounds from across the world, like Phil calling us by our names and demanding its rightful tears. It will never be impervious. The memory can be hurt time and again, but in that may lie its final mercy. As long as it's vulnerable to the living moment, it lives for us. And while it lives, and while we are able, we can give it up its due. From outside in the driveway came the sound of a car arriving and the bridesmaid's tattoo on the horn. "Take it," said Faye. "It'll give me one less thing to get rid of." "Never mind," said Laurel, laying the breadboard down on the table where it belonged. "I think I can get along without that, too." Memory lived not in initial possession, but in the freed hands, pardoned and freed, and in the heart that can empty but fill again, in the patterns restored by dreams. Laurel passed Faye and went into the hall, took up her coat and handbag. Missouri came running along the porch in time to reach for her suitcase. Laurel pressed her quickly to her, sped down the steps into the car where the bridesmaids were waiting, holding the door open for her and impatiently calling her name. "There now," Tish said. "You'll make it by the skin of your teeth." They flashed by the courthouse, turned at the school. Miss Adele was out with her first graders, grouped for a game in the yard. She waved. So did the children. The last thing Laurel saw before they whirled into speed was the twinkling of their hands, the many small and unknown hands wishing her goodbye. In opening herself up to the fluidity and ache of memory, to its creative and imaginative passions, Laurel is also better able to leave behind the stifling parts of her past, even parts that are comfortingly familiar, like the breadboard. Her heart is emptied and able to fill again because she has come to own not a physical possession, but her own capacity to make the continuity of her love for Phil, for her mother, for her father, and perhaps even for Faye, weave through her life, even as she also acknowledges how very much her relationships with them have left her angry, afraid, and wounded as well. I find Welty's view of memory as opposed to the past, as a force that we live with, are vulnerable to, and shape, to be extremely powerful. I also find the image of Laurel's pardoned and freed hands and her quivering heart, which has let go of attempting to control or stave off loss, to be a state that I both avoid and crave. Let me be more specific and draw on a few examples from my own life. For most of my years, I've worked hard to avoid loss and failure. I've tended to not try things that I'm not good at. I've had close friends, but have tried to not depend too much on anyone. During my college years, when relationships became uncomfortable, I was likely to avoid confrontation because more likely than not, I'd be moving to a new apartment, getting new roommates, taking a new class, getting a new job. After I got married, I felt stunned at how vulnerable to loss I had made myself. I had dared to care deeply about another person, so much that I had dared to believe in a vision of what our life could be like together. But even as I took steps towards that vision, I realized how fragile the realization of that vision was. Mark could be killed at any moment. He could decide to change in ways that I never would have expected or wanted. He could find that he no longer loved me. And the same could happen with me. I felt this vulnerability even more when I gave birth to our daughter, Emma. I distinctly remember feeling, although I'm not sure at all of the physiology of this, right after she was born, I distinctly remember feeling the emotional equivalent of what my uterus had just been through. When I looked into her large dark eyes, I really felt this, that my heart started to have contractions. I felt like Dr. Seuss's Grinch, whose heart grew 3 sizes in one day. I felt physical pain. My heart seemed to be literally breaking open and aching as it made room for this person, this child with whom loss and pain would be inevitable. I kept wondering, how will we do this? How can we be responsible for having called her into being in this world? I had to reckon with her humanness, with my humanness, in those moments, and acknowledge that both of us, imperfect and open to hurt and to being hurt, would also share a bond of love. I don't have the time to speak further about how I continue to struggle with loss and my desire to control and eradicate it. But I do think that as I've gotten older and as I've read more of Eudora Welty, I've gotten a bit better at moving away from initial possessions and towards pardoning and freeing my own hands and those of others. I believe that the prospect of living with pain, loss, and betrayal while still opening our hearts to be emptied and filled again with love is what the Christian quest is all about. As Laurel saw, life is nothing but the continuity of its love.
I was born and raised in the suburbs of Lizard Gulch, Utah, which is to say that's about as rural as one can get. But along the way, a wonderful gift came to me from whence I know not where. As a small redhead face, freckled face boy growing up in a home, even toward the high school years, without water, without electricity, in quite abject poverty. I had this insatiable love for literature and for religion and for philosophy that seeped into my bones and sent me on a wayward quest that has brought an infinite and indescribable joy to a striving soul. And in these traditions, I have found nutrients to sustain and fulfill a life, and to secure from it a grand meaning and a grand affirmation. I list as my first book one of the greatest writers and thinkers the world has ever known. I just simply found him somewhere along the line and fell in love with him. And of all of the brilliant things he wrote, I select one little thing that can be read by anyone in 15 minutes. And I always interjected it somewhere along the line in the philosophy classes I taught over the years. Plato's Allegory of the Cave from the Republic. Professor Ulick, philosophy professor of mine at Harvard, once said it is ironic that the first book ever written in Western civilization to the grand idea of justice in the human condition has never to this hour been equaled. And this little parable impacted me in such an unbelievable way. As a Mormon, I might claim that Jesus Christ placed him, Plato, at the head waters of all Western philosophy because he was the best. And I can't read the 13th Article of Faith, which is one of the most grand paragraphs in Mormon literature, without recognizing that that's Plato. That's Plato in the 13th Article of Faith. It's the Platonic trilogy that moved me early, that all of us as mortals ought to be at the task of seeking out the good and the true and the beautiful. And that's hard to improve on as an aim, as a goal, as an objective, if we wish to affirm life against vicissitude, against tragedy, and against despair. In the sense that I suppose Christ placed Jefferson, Madison, Franklin to midwife a young democracy. And so here's this little cave that represents the mortal condition. There were the blinders and the manacles and the imprisoned condition of the subjects, meaning humankind. And the only reality they knew was the reality of their experience, being the shadows on the wall. But one time there was this turning point. Let's call it, in our little story, the first of two grand turning points of wondering what caused the curriculum of our reality in the shadows on the wall. And you get loose from the manacles. You find the courage or whatever it takes to be oneself, and to take that gallant step. And you find a roadway behind. That's the way the story goes. There's a roadway, you see, from this cave, this underground abode, he called it. And on this roadway, there were objects held up. And there was a fire in the cave behind the objects that cast these shadows, then on the wall. And the person who got freed and moved back to discover that and saw these mannequins, these objects held upon sticks, crossing by on the roadway, casting that life of reality for the mass on the wall. Wow. You see, Plato doesn't have us in an argument here of theology or metaphysics or ontology with somebody else where you close yourself off. He's brought you into this little story and leads you walking yourself like you were there with him. This is his genius in his artistic, poetic capability to create. Harvard's historian, Craig Brin, once said, Plato, Pascal, Nietzsche, Will James were the four born writers of the West. Maybe so, and Pascal and Plato were much alike, the greatest mathematicians of their era, genius, gifted, two of the greatest writers the world has ever known, and they wrote philosophy and brilliance and genius in the language of poetry. And you can't get better literature than grand philosophical wisdom clothed in the language of the poetic. And then to discover then the world of the mannequins, the objects held up, creating the shadows on the wall. It just simply turns out that these are illusionary also and not really real. But you go up the rugged ascent and get outside of the cave, and you find a shadow of the real. Well, the shadow of the real out there in the light of day is not real either. It's just more real than the mannequin creating the shadow on the wall. And then you observe the reflections of persons and objects in the water, you see, which are more real than their shadow, and then the objects themselves. Well, if you know Plato, he almost gets into some Mormon things here, if you want to go on with that. He doesn't deal with it in the little allegory, but you see the spiritual creation, the physical creation, Platonic idealism, Aristotelian realism, you see, tied in there. They weren't doing badly. Not bad. And so I find this an encompassing, really, of the whole human condition. And the Bunyan brothers used to put it to me like this at luncheons. If you're not on common ground with another, then the discussion is over before it begins. And when we are on various levels of reality, and Plato has just walked us through five or six of them, even in love, communication becomes almost impossible. And thus, if you pursue these traditions to the ultimate, you will end up an isolated person to all those whom you love. That's kind of a sad fruit, isn't it? For the pursuit of something so lofty. And yet maybe it's a price one has to pay to be worthy. To be worthy of being able to love such traditions. Matthew Arnold called it the best that has been spoken and written by the men and women who are the artists, who have suffered sufficiently to write something that could move the soul. Second, I just simply tribute Sterling McMurrin's Religion, Reason, and Truth. I find in the middle of it his three pages on the philosophy of religion, the most profound statement I've ever read. And I read it over and over again. And I suppose the only other kind of an experience that has gone beyond that with him. At 82, of course, he left us. We missed him. Miss him. Is to go to Cowboy Grub and just have a 3-hour dialectic with him. Because I always came away on a cloud, feeling that this is a Mormon. And in his knowledge and in his honesty and in his search for truth, he is unbelievably special. And it would just take me a week to come down from it. And was honored to be his friend. I skipped that, but have a few copies of that. If anybody would like a copy, I might have one for you. Third, as a school superintendent in the Chicago area during the 70s, I came to Salt Lake City on Tuesday, the 3rd of January, 1978, having made arrangements to spend a half a day with Sterling McMurrin in the morning, and the other half the day with Lowell Bunyan in his office. And that was my day, and I took some of our daughters, as I recall, with me. And I ask a dumb question, that is, one who has 10,000 books in one's private home, I ask a dumb question, you know, to men of this quality, is there a singular book that seemed to transcend all others in sinking within your own soul. And I went home in my journals that night and wrote that both men gave me the same book, the same author and the same book. And I thought, well, I have to have that book. And then I got thinking, you know, as a person in education, that maybe what they appreciated about this book were Mormon concepts written more brilliantly and profoundly than in the tradition out of which they had come. And that's about what I concluded. So I worked with a book dealer on the North Shore of Chicago till I had copies for each member of my family. William Pepperell Montague's little book called Belief Unbound, A Promethean Religion for the Modern World. And just to close this off, two little quick samples from it. The purpose and value sought by the great life God is the same as that of the lesser lives within. No fixed telos or end, but a maximum increase of life itself. Not merely or primarily an increase in the number of all lives, but rather a greater enrichment, enhancement, and expansion of each life. For God, as for us all, goods are relative, variable, and growing. New values are generated by old, and new summits of beauty are revealed from the summits already ascended. But also it is true that for God, as for us, the form of good remains constant through the flux of content. Sterling used to say it, cowboy grub, it's like a river. Montague would describe it like a river. The riverbed remains fixed and firm, but the content of the flowing river, you see, is the ever-changing ethic. Life absolute and life relative create their own unchanging ways to their own unlimited growth, the twofold way of virtue, and ever more intensive enthusiasm. That's the uranium within us. And an ever more extensive love. He called these the two great supreme human virtues. Get the uranium burning out of the soul to let people know you love life every day and wish to affirm it. And believe in life. And believe in yourself. And the self of another. And that's within, you see. And then reach out from that narcissistic self to the whole world out there in love. And he says another. This is so moving. And talk about religion. I just impose it on you for another minute, knowing time's gone. We are what we will to be at this present moment, and not what we have been up to the present moment.